Welcome to the Research Impact podcast series. I'm your host, Helena Lenihan, Professor of Economics and Chair of the University of Limerick's Research Impact Committee. On today's episode, we will be meeting with colleagues from the Aging Research Centre based here at the University of Limerick. I'm delighted to say that the Aging Research Centre members are winners of this year's UL President's Research Excellence and Impact Outstanding Research Collaboration Award for 2023. Research from the Aging Research Centre has been truly instrumental in driving the adoption and integration of innovative healthcare models for older adults and their family caregivers. This research has played a pivotal role in shaping national policies pertaining to health and social care for older adults. Joining me today are Professor Rose Galvin, who's a professor in physiotherapy at the School of Allied Health here at the University of Limerick. Also joining us is Professor Katie Robinson, who's a professor of occupational therapy, also at the School of Allied Health. We also have Dr. Aoife Whiston and Dr. Christine Fitzgerald, both of whom are postdoctoral researchers in the Aging Research Centre. And we're delighted to also welcome Una Breen, Monica O'Loughlin, and Bernard Collins, the three of whom are members of the Aging Research Centre stakeholder panel of older adults and family caregivers. So, Katie, I might kick off with you, if that's okay. I'm curious to know, even as somebody who's worked in UL for the last number of years, how did the Aging Research Centre come about and who's involved in it?
Thanks for the lovely congratulations, Helena. Yeah, the Aging Research Centre formally came into being at the end of 2019, so we're about 4 years old, but really, for a number of years before that, there was a lot of people working in the broad area of aging research. And when the Health Research Institute put out a call for funding to support capacity building in some thematic areas of health, a group of us who were interested in aging research got together, put in an application, got some funding, and that really kickstarted us as a group and formalized us. We got a formal name together, we started a Twitter account, and we got a bit more serious about what we were doing. Around the same time, we established this stakeholder panel of older adults and family caregivers. And it's fabulous to have Monica, Bernard and Una here with us today. And I know we'll really benefit from hearing about their experiences later on as we're talking today. We got that stakeholder panel together and we have about 12 members who have been meeting pretty consistently over the last 4 years. And that has hugely enriched the work that we're doing in the group.
So just on that, Katie, we've heard about the stakeholder panel and it'll be great that we'll hear from the colleagues later on. I suppose we all talk about kind of excellent research with impact and that we should have influence on the real world and get people from the real world, as we call it, involved in what we do. I think the listeners today would be interested in how do you get stakeholders involved in your research?
Yeah, for sure, Helena. And we benefit hugely from colleagues in who were funded through PPI Ignite, and Professor Anne McFarland did some training with us at the early stage of when we were establishing this panel.
Just curious, what does PPI stand for?
So this type of work that you're talking about involving real end users, stakeholders in research, making sure that the questions we develop, the research we do is relevant to their lives and will have impact. That's sometimes called patient and public involvement in research, and it's shortened to PPI. When we were starting to get this stakeholder panel of older adults and family caregivers together, we asked ourselves, because older adults aren't really a very homogenous group, like they're very diverse. You're talking about people from 65 up to 100 plus years of age, people who are healthy, people who are living with health complaints, people across all socio-demographic sectors of society. And so we said to ourselves, who we are really interested in are older adults who are using health services or have used health services in the past. And so we went around Limerick, Clare, and told various groups of older adults what we were doing and asked them would they be interested in joining our panel. So we presented to men's sheds, carers groups, healthy aging, active aging groups. Some of them were delighted to hear about the work, but weren't really interested in coming on the panel. And in the end, we recruited about 12 older adults and family caregivers who were interested in aging research, who had lived experience of using health services in Ireland, and just shared with us a passion for improving the situation of older adults and their health outcomes. So that's how we got the panel together. And then, you know, we meet every 6 weeks or so, usually in the South Court Hotel, to try and keep things accessible in a local venue here in Limerick City. And we have worked together on many, many different studies, different study designs, done lots of work from the early stages of shaping up. For example, myself and Una worked together on a couple of grant applications focused on how older people experience care in the emergency department. And Una herself shared with me her own experience of lengthy waiting periods in the emergency department and the challenges she faced in having her needs met in that complex and busy environment. So from that stage of shaping up research ideas at the grant stage all the way through to completing studies and disseminating them, we've had the involvement of older adults, and meeting together with that panel helps us stay grounded, stay focused, reminds us as researchers about what matters to older people, stops us getting carried away with ourselves sometimes in terms of what we think is important. And in very practical ways, if we design materials for information sheets or consent forms for recruiting people into studies, being able to share them with older people and asking them, does it make sense? Is it accessible? What concerns do you have after reading it? That has just helped us make sure that the materials we use in research are appropriate for this group too.
That's really interesting, Katie, and thanks for sharing that with us. And clearly you've got fantastic engagement on the ground from the stakeholder panel, because we've got three of them here today. So it's great to welcome again Una, Bernard and Monica. So I think we'd just be curious to know, what has taking part in the panel been like for you? What has your experiences been like? So maybe one of you'd like to kick off on that.
I'm Monica, and I was listening to a talk by a member of Clare County Council, and I asked a question. It was with regard to facilities for older people in the community. And I asked her privately a few things and asked me to know, would I be interested in joining a study group in UL? I couldn't believe it, because I was always interested in everything. All my life, I wanted to know more and more about everything. And I'm a nurse by profession. And I think my greatest interest was because I had stayed at home for 30 years. I have a big family. And I went back after 30 years. So when I went back, I was in my mid-50s. And I went to an acute hospital. Ennis was acute at the time. I went back to nursing in Limerick. So I learned a lot from the fact that I'd aged 30 years. And I could see how neglect of various areas of your life would influence how well or otherwise you would be when you get older. I was an outpatient, so most of the people I met were older people. And I also saw that even if I knew it within myself somehow, that the primary thing for all the patients, because the young students would ask me, why did you go back? Well, how could you go back now? And I said, you'd be surprised what you learn for 30 years at home, you know, because you learn so much. And then I said, the primary thing was that everybody wished to be treated with kindness, the number one. Everything else then, I said, will come in behind that. Because if you wish to be kind, you wish them to get better. You wish them to be, and, you know, various little things. And the idea of coming to a study group where I met Rose was the first person to contact me, and I felt that I was welcome whenever I'd go. And I must say, I'm really encouraged by the group of people we've been with all the time. And the one thing that stood out was the kindness and the listening. And even if I'd love to be standing in front of student nurses and hope they mightn't all listen. But the one thing that's most important is that everybody, just everybody, knows if they're being listened to. It's the one thing that. And even from the best outcome in health-wise, I mean, if you're listening to the patient, and I would say, because I did my midwifery as well, so even at that age, I would know that if, you know, it's basic to all of us, well, to the older, I suppose, my basic common sense is that when somebody is telling you something, if you listen, it's amazing, from the youngest child to the oldest person, they know if you're listening. And that's the number one. And I find that with the research group that I'm encouraged as well, because of all these people that are really interested in improving the welfare for all of us as we're progressing through life. And everybody has older people in their own house. If they're not older now, they have older people of different, whether it's parents, relations, neighbours, whatever it is. And I had an experience in a clinic where you were in LA, a clinic where you were to book in before you leave home and or wherever you are, and you sign online. you sign on the phone. And I was saying, this is a health service. And older people, first of all, they have all sorts of arthritis, Parkinson's, all the older illnesses, really, things that, and as well as that, it's all new to them. And when I signed, then the whole thing cleared the sheet. But when I went to the building in Limerick here, the girl that was there, a lovely girl, and she said, sure, but that's why we're here. We'll show you how to do that. So I said, hold on a minute now. I said, I grew up when we had no electricity. I was 11 when we got electricity. And I was from near Ennis. I was 8 miles from Ennis only. I wasn't out in the sticks. So I said, can you imagine how difficult it is for people? I'm 74. And I said, so we have people 84, you have 94s. And you have a lot of people that don't have family and don't have stayed up with things. I sound very enthusiastic because I am. I'm interested. And I'd feel that if I could influence the welfare of others, even only a few, I would really be happy that I joined the group.
Thank you very much, Monica, for sharing your experiences with us. Bernard, it'd be really interesting to hear what has your experiences been like. Do you feel you've influenced any of their research projects in any way?
I don't know, to be honest about it. I come from a strange background in that I worked in a managerial capacity in the health service for 40 years. And I'm married to another health manager who is encyclopedic in that she has worked in all branches of the health service.
You're well embedded there.
So I've heard a lot of stories, and being involved with the group, it's amazing the things you hear and the difficulties people have. People suddenly, you know, who are very active, who are high profile people in their working lives, they've suddenly become carers maybe. They've suddenly developed a difficulty about things like technology, driving, getting from A to B. Their lack of knowledge of the health services, what their entitlements are, how they go about it, you know, the amount of information that's available out there, how they can access that. And Monica touched on something there that it bothers me greatly, is a community involvement with older people. Maybe it still exists in rural Ireland, but it's very much gone, I think, in suburbia. Most people don't know their neighbours. And you could have a situation, or you could have a lone person living alone, and they wouldn't have communication with anybody from one end of the week to the other. In older times, everyone went to mass, and if somebody didn't turn up, somebody missed them. No, very few people go to mass, so... You know, it's a different story. The breakdown of community involvement, I think, is one issue that strikes me as being very important and very evident as well. The difficulty now even of, say, you getting ill and getting a doctor to come out to you is quite incredible. I remember a number of years ago, my own wife got ill on a Saturday morning, and I knew my way around the services, and I still had a hell of a difficulty getting a doctor for her. I'm not saying the health services should advertise their wares, but people should have some way of knowing where to look and where to find their entitlements. The other thing that I would be very worried about is, and that came across from the group too, is that people being taken out of their environment and all their social supports being gone. You suddenly have all your social supports, you know, where everything you have in your house that you've built up over a whole lifetime, you move out into a nursing home or wherever, gone, you know. I think that's very traumatic for people. It has to be, you know. I keep thinking about it myself because it might be coming down the road, but anyway.
I doubt that, Bernard, I'm just kind of curious, and maybe, you know, one of Rose or Katie might like to come in on this before we go to Monica for her experiences. How does it work in practical terms? Do you meet all the stakeholders together? Do you throw out some open-ended questions? Do you have a research question in mind and then change it after you speak with the stakeholders? You know, how does it inform the research? Just curious about how that works.
That's a very good question, Helena. And what Bernard really has described there is what is core to our research. So the needs and preferences of older adults. And quite often that is to live independently in their own homes and in their own communities. So that is one huge thematic area of the Ageing Research Centre, and the work that we do is to identify strategies and innovations to support people to live well in their own homes. But in practical terms, the group meets once every 6 weeks in the South Court, as Katie mentioned. And on reflecting on how the group has come together and evolved, two consistent partners in that group have always been Katie or I that would attend. So we often have researchers who attend with different research questions. So lots of our PhD students would have benefited from the voices of older adults in designing their projects, disseminating their projects. And we've lots of lovely examples of where the group have contributed to writing a lay dissemination or a lay summary of work that has been done. But broadly speaking, when we meet, we have a discussion over different things that might have happened. And then we would present one or two projects to the group. And that could be around co-designing a research question, for example. It could be around, okay, well, we've found these results and will you help us interpret the findings? Are these results meaningful to you? Or is this reflective of what matters most to you in your life? So these are the kind of questions we pose to the older adult stakeholders. And as Katie mentioned, people have such diverse views and opinions on what the results are that they've really helped us shape kind of a more authentic, rounded summary of our findings.
I think I asked Monica at the beginning, do you think your insights have enhanced the research? I think we can clearly say that all of your insights have truly enhanced the research. And I think it strikes me as somebody who's not an expert in this area as just a real life lab to get the feedback, to engage, to hear different views. Monica picked up the notion of listening to each other. All of those things seem key. Now, Una, we might turn to you, if that's okay, to just pose the question, why did you get involved in this? And more to the point, why have you decided to remain involved in this stakeholder group?
I got involved with it in a different roundabout way from everyone else because it's been going on for years with me. I don't know how it started in the first place, but when a student here would be doing research for their PhD, my name got passed on to them. You know, like the one that comes to mind is years and years ago, this girl, she used to come to, they always seemed to come to my house and do interviews with me and they would film little bits of it then, you know. One of them was a research into how older people manage medication. At the time, I was on a tablet for something or other, and they were in, you know, the little packs where you press it out of the metal bit. And the company, in their infinite wisdom, decided to get new packaging. And the bit that pressed out was, it wasn't just metallic, it was actually heavy plastic as well. So you had to get a screwdriver or a sledgehammer or whatever to get the tablet out. And I don't have great strength in my hands from arthritis. The tablets were for arthritis, for arthritic people. And I wrote the company a very stiff letter about this, you know. And she did a whole project on this, you know, and with me filmed, trying my best, my tongue sticking out between my teeth, trying to get the tablet out, you know. But that's one that comes to mind. There were always little projects like that for different students. And I just felt I was helping somebody. And it was fun. It was interesting. And I think it was through that somebody passed my name on to either Rose or Katie, I don't know. But
that's excellent.
I've really, getting back to it, I have really enjoyed being part of, especially of this group. It's great. It's astonishing that people actually listen to older people, you know? Because, I mean, once you hit 65, you begin to become slightly invisible. And like Monica was saying, you could pass somebody on the road and, you know, they just don't even see you. You could be stark naked, they still wouldn't see you, you know. Once you hit 77, you're really invisible.
Yeah.
With this group, it's lovely. You feel you're actually making the tiniest bit of difference. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know, but I'd like to think we are.
Yeah. Thanks very much for
and
that.
It's
Una.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
The projects are all very interesting, what they're doing.
Curiosity seems to be a theme that's coming up.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
Monica mentioned it and you mentioned it again. And clearly, Bernard, you're curious by nature. What strikes me really is the kind of practice impact of what's going on here. If we were to kind of aggregate that up to a kind of a policy level, can somebody around the table maybe share some insights on the policy impact of this, of your research?
Absolutely. So one of the earlier projects we were involved in, Helena, was looking at older adults who attend the emergency department. So for some older adults, attending the emergency department is important because they need a hospital admission. But for other older adults, they may get a discharge on the same day. But quite often that discharge is hampered by lack of access to services in the community. And given a huge number of people in the Ageing Research Centre have backgrounds in allied health disciplines, so physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, dietetics, nursing, medicine, you know, music therapy, lots of different disciplines, but in particular, the allied health disciplines. So we looked at, could the allied health disciplines support older people to get home from the emergency department a little bit quicker? And we ran the first trial internationally to look at, if we implemented this model of care in the emergency department, could this get people out of the emergency department a little bit quicker? And what we found is that if we implemented a dedicated team who were experts in the area of older adult care, this team of allied health disciplines could get people home quicker. So these older adults would spend less time in the emergency department, and also the risk of them getting admitted to hospital was also significantly reduced. So that fed into national policy guidelines, particularly around allied health disciplines and the role we can play in supporting older people to live well. But also the National Clinical Programme for Older People have used that trial as an example of evidence-based practice and have implemented these teams across all emergency departments nationally.
Okay, so there's been a full rollout of the trial or the pilot or whatever.
Absolutely.
And as an economist, I'd like to quantify this. Have we any way of saying how much it reduced the times or...
It reduced the time in the emergency department by half, but also it reduced the incidence of admission to hospital by about 40% also. So we collaborated with a health economist in Trinity College Dublin, Professor Dominic Treppel, and we did a full-scale economic evaluation of this model of care and found that we were saving the state around €7,000 in healthcare costs, and that was largely driven by the reduction in admission to hospital. But one of the things we discovered from this project, yes, we got older adults out of the hospital a little bit quicker, but they were coming back to the emergency department at the same rate as if they had never received this intervention.
Very interesting.
So when we looked more broadly at this, and we've lots of PhD students working in this area, one of the things we found is a PhD student with Katie found that older adults, when they leave the emergency department, they often experience unresolved symptoms. And that is a big driver of return to the emergency department. And the other thing that was problematic for older people is that there was fragmentation of care. So because they transitioned from one healthcare setting to another healthcare setting, the communication across those settings is often suboptimal. So then we worked on those findings, the findings generated by Brian Condon, who's an occupational therapy PhD student, and we developed an integrated model of care. And that was funded by the Health Research Board of Ireland to the tune of 1.5 million to look at, well, how can we support older people transitioning out of the emergency department? And we had a PhD student, Maury Keneally, who is a physiotherapist, and she looked at an intervention that initiated in the emergency department. So older people met a group of allied health professionals in the emergency department, and one of those healthcare professionals acted as their key contact point. And what they did was they followed them into the community within 24 to 48 hours of their discharge from the emergency department and worked with them over a period of 6 weeks to ensure that their health and social care needs were met. Be they, you know, appointments for scans, for x-rays, for physiotherapy, occupational therapy, medicines, reviews, all of these. And that trial found huge benefits for older people. So what older people reported is having one contact person was very valuable to them. They really, you know, remarked that that was something that was really important to them, but also that their quality of life improved, their satisfaction with their care improved, because they felt that they had just one person to go to and that one person listened to them and coordinated their care. And I know Maureen's work, Una was involved in writing a lay summary of that PhD work. Maureen just graduated earlier in the year, but I know that Una was heavily involved in writing a lay summary of that work. So that's just one kind of tangible example of how older adults not just shaped the design of the research question, but also its dissemination.
And how did that work in terms of writing the lay summary?
I really enjoyed it, actually. It's great because I was so interested in the study. It was so down to earth and it just seemed to be worth every penny of money laid out and doctors coming together and doing all the different stuff. It just seemed to be so cost effective. That's how it seemed to me anyway, because I know so many older people who have they've been treated for, we'll say, some one problem in hospital, but the main problem, nobody's even asked them, how's your whatever like, you know what I mean?
No, that's really good.
It's like a body can actually have a lot of problems with it as it gets older. People don't seem to realize that, you know, and if you treat the whole person, it's going to be a lot more cost effective, I think, in the long run. you know.
This is really interesting on a host of levels. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really excellent example of the kind of true pathway to impact, beginning at the beginning, then the outcome, the one point of contact. And also what strikes me as I listen today is this notion of to tackle these kind of big problems or maybe smaller problems within health, you need lots of different disciplines looking at it together. And just to say that Dominic Treppel is XUL PhD in economics. So we're going to claim him partly as well.
Right. And just to say, Helena, also something we should be very proud of that we have led at the University of Limerick is the development of core standards of care for older adults who attend the emergency department. And this really was born out of variation in older adults who attend the emergency department across EDs nationally, receiving different standards of care from frailty at the front door teams. So what we did was worked with all of these teams nationally to develop consensus on core standards of care for older adults who attend the emergency department. So that if you're an older adult in Dublin, in Munster, in Kerry, Clare, Limerick, Cork, wherever you attend the emergency department, you can be guaranteed core standards of healthcare from these specialist frailty at the front door teams. That work was completed by researchers at UL in collaboration with the National Clinical Programme for Older Persons.
So maybe now we might just kind of tack a little bit on this and come back to or engage a little bit more with what are you currently working on?
Absolutely, Helena. And I might highlight, so as a result of Maury Keneally's work, one of the projects we're now looking at is upscaling that project. So she just ran what we call a pilot study, looking at, is this feasible? Is it acceptable to older people? Are they happy with it? You know, how would it work in practice? So one of the things we have planned early in the new year is to scale this up across the Midwest. So scale it up so that all older people across the Midwest, in Limerick, in Clare, in Tipperary, that everyone has equal access to availing of this integrated care intervention. But one of the things we also found, and Christine, my colleague, will speak to this, is the invaluable role that home care workers play in supporting older adults to remain in their own homes. And Christine initiated a project that has subsequently received external funding, and she might speak to that project around home care workers.
Thanks, Christine.
Great. Thanks very much, Rose. So the piece of research that Rose has mentioned has been, I suppose, initially it was funded by the IRC, the New Foundations Funding Board. And key to this was a collaboration with ClareCare, who are an organisation who provide home-based care in County Clare, across County Clare. So the Ageing Research Centre had collaborated with them, again, identified what was a priority in terms of their practice working to keep older people living in their own homes, which is obviously a key policy priority. And one of the challenges at the time around the funding was the impact that COVID-19 had on the home care worker workforce. So that was the research project that we completed summer of last year. And this was really important because even before the pandemic hit, home care workers were facing a lot of challenges. You know, there's a lot of long hours, low enough pay, which led to high turnover of staff and retention issues. And considering there's going to be a greater focus on an older population and policy orientation to keep these people living at home, we really needed to understand all of these challenges that had been exacerbated by COVID-19. So we did a lovely piece of qualitative work last summer where we did focus groups with three different groups of home care workers across Clare to capture what had been the impact from their experience working through COVID. And these, again, it's important to remember, one of the few groups that continued to provide home care for older people living in their own homes and communities during COVID. So they had kind of unique perspectives that hadn't really been captured in the research to date. So we did data collection supported with the research partner. And what we found from that was that the impact really crossed the barrier from the professional impact in terms of their day-to-day tasks, PPE utilization, transmission fears, and it really impacted their personal lives. So we had examples of home care workers who felt, and Bernard touched on this, for a lot of people, the home care worker was the only person that they saw during COVID. They had nobody else coming in or out. They mightn't have family living nearby. So this, while very helpful for the older person, put a huge sense of responsibility and duty of care on the home care worker. And this had a lot of emotional impact in terms of the level of support that they needed to provide, particularly for people using the service who had lost family members and friends. So even just in terms of supporting bereavement for their client users. So I suppose the tasks and duties in terms of support and emotional recognition for the client really changed, and the impact that that had on the staff themselves. Again, a lot of concerns were highlighted around transmission fears, both for the person's home that they were going into, but a lot of people spoke about their own families who had had older parents living at home, vulnerable family members, even people at younger children who felt accountability and responsibility around who were they mixing with. And again, huge kind of emotional, psychological impact for the home care worker. So they were just some of the kind of wide-ranging impact that we had learned from the qualitative piece of work.
Just on that, Christine, I'm curious to know two things really. Was there anything that you found that you said, that's really surprising, I wouldn't have thought of that beforehand? And then the second question, as a researcher myself, that I'm curious about, so you've kind of got the pre-pandemic, then you looked at the impact of the pandemic. Do you plan on rolling out another study?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing, I think what was most surprising, first of all, like there hasn't been a lot of research done with this group. A particular focus has been on acute setting health and social care professionals. So it really strengthened the evidence base internationally. What we really recognized was the duty of care amongst all of the home care workers. And these were people ranging in different age groups across different suburban and rural areas. But the just entrenched duty of care, the responsibility, the often guilt that they felt to continue to provide the care. So they all felt that if I'm sick, if I'm in isolation, who's actually going to come in and care for this older person? And I suppose that really drove the sense of the impact, because it was a genuine feeling of responsibility and care that even through the pandemic was really, really strong in evidence. So I think that was really interesting and valuable to capture. And through this research, we hope to make sure that we can better support home care workers to continue to do their role in a kind of safer, more responsive way. And in terms of a larger focus on it, we have just recently secured additional funding from the IRC New Foundation grant, and that is going to roll out in springtime. We're going to partner with ClearCare again, and we're also going to partner with the National Community Care Network, and we're going to use our qualitative findings to develop a national study to capture a much broader, diverse group of insights into exploring at a deeper level, I suppose, what impact did this had, and can we link the experiences from the qualitative to a broader picture. And just in terms of collaboration, Aoife Whiston, who's an expert in stats, has made it so much easier for us to, you know, disseminate our findings to a more diverse group. So I think one of the really nice things about the Aging Research Centre is we all work together. If there's areas that we have not that much experience in, somebody else can come in and support. And even in terms of publications and dissemination, it's really makes our work much more easily accessible and has much more impact.
Excellent. I thought it was curious as I listened to you that you spoke about this type of research has been carried out in the past much more in acute settings. I just think to myself, you know, through life, we've always had people who've got older. We've always had older adults. Why is the reason that there has been a lack of focus on this cohort of really valuable individuals? You might like to give us some insights on that one, Katie.
Yeah, Helena, I think first of all, probably one issue that really impacts on the visibility of older adults and the attention that's paid to older adults, whether it's in research or our policy, is ageism. It's endemic. You know, we're all vulnerable to it, to having stereotypes about older adults in our mind and to negative perceptions of older adults. And I think that, you know, has a huge and a real impact on the attention paid to older adults. And I suppose in terms of the timing of when the Aging Research Centre was founded and why we took that major focus on aging as something that would pull us together and coordinate our research, the way in which our population is changing is very dramatic. We know that populations across Europe are getting older, but Ireland is actually the fastest aging population in Europe, aging faster than any other European country at the moment. And in just 5 years' time, we will have more people over the age of 65 than we have kids under the age of 14. And so it's not just that we have more older people in Ireland, the proportion of our population that comprises older adults is getting bigger. Older people are living longer. This is like not to be seen as a problem. And this is something we talk about all the time, Rose and I, when we're shaping up grants or projects. We say to ourselves, are we problematizing older people? Is there kind of a subtext here that says older people are the problem? And sometimes in newspapers, you know, the way in which older adults as emergency department users are portrayed is just so negative, like as if they're a burden on society, a problem to be. And that is just never the type of approach we want to take. And we're just so careful of saying to ourselves and reminding ourselves that people living longer is and just a fabulous success story. It's a success story of public health and of all the policy initiatives that have been implemented over the last number of decades. And what we want to do is make sure that these extra years that people are living, like a baby born today, a baby girl born today, can expect to live to 84 years of age. And we want those extra years that people are living to be healthy, high quality years that people live in their own homes and communities, free from illnesses or able to self-manage the health conditions that they may develop.
Thanks for sharing that, Katie. I think you're right. I think most times when we read in the media about demographics, it's like as if it's all going to cost us so much money and it's a problem. It's really interesting that you take it from a different perspective. And I think that's been one of the themes that's come up today. The holistic way you approach your research, the holistic way you engage with your stakeholders, all of those issues. Now I'm going to turn to the statistician on my left-hand side. You got a nice intro there from Christine earlier, so we won't let you get away with it. Just wondering, as a postdoctoral researcher in the Aging Research Centre, how does the centre support early career researchers?
Yeah, so thanks, Christine, for that introduction. So I started my postdoc with the Aging Research Centre in January. And I suppose the first thing that comes to mind with the Aging Research Centre is collaboration. I think I was in my postdoc for 3 days and I was sitting in front of the National Clinical Programme for Older People presenting some results that we had done during the week. And it's just, that's the great thing about the centre is that everyone is there to support you, push you to reach your full potential. So as well as that, within a week, I think I was in front of the PPI panel, the Public Patient Involvement panel. So people we have here today. And I came from a psychology background and had done a bit of work on depression. So I was presenting a study about depression in older adults, and the panel were going to pick out things that might influence depression in older adults. And I went with a set idea in my head of this is what I think will impact. And it wasn't too long after the conversation that I realized I actually hadn't a clue. And the factors or the things that this group of older adults picked out shaped the research question, and they completely changed what was going to be included into the study going forward. So it was from that moment on, I suppose, that I realized the importance of public patient involvement. And the collaborations, I suppose, don't stop there. So in a lot of the research we've done to date, we're engaging with University Hospital Limerick, or whether it be charity organizations. I've been given the opportunity to present at these outreach days as well. So for example, we had an Aging with Impact Research Day event, which was held in the University Hospital Limerick. And we had members of the public patient involvement panel. We had clinicians, the public were invited. And it was a day that we could present research that is done together at the Aging Research Centre to a wider audience. So that's something that I've really kind of gained from the Aging Research Centre, is being able to translate what we do day to day into, I suppose, research for everyone to understand. Another thing is obviously the training. So the training that we get as postdoctoral researchers here is amazing. So whether it is equipping you to be part of the public and patient involvement panel by doing workshops, whether it's how to run trials, we've done a lot of different kind of training days as well. Obviously, I think the best thing is the disciplines that are involved. So like what Christine was saying, if you're running a study, you're never more than, I'd say, nearly an office away from someone who can help collaborate on the project. And it's an extremely collaborative group. And I think that's what's really helped in all the research that we do. It's truly shaped by multidisciplinary professionals, and it helps get a wider reach on the research as well.
Thanks, Aoife. Rose, I'm just curious to pick up on something there that Aoife spoke about, and that's the collaboration with the clinical partners. The UL Hospitals group, really busy people. You know, Aoife mentioned them there. How did your group get the clinical partners to get as engaged as clearly they are listening here today?
Yeah, so we have fabulous clinical partners across the spectrum, are in UL Hospitals Group and in the community health organisation. And one thing you described earlier, Helena, that struck me was this concept of a living lab. And actually, where we live, UL Hospitals Group and the community health organisation map onto one another perfectly. So if we discharge an older adult from UL Hospitals Group, any one of the hospitals, then we can capture where they go in the community health organisation. And that is unique to this hospital group. So that is a huge advantage. We can track older adults in the community health organisation when they're discharged from the hospital group. But in terms of establishing, you know, relationships with clinical partners, this was, you know, a slow burner, because when we started working, even in the emergency department, and introducing allied health professionals, so introducing physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech and language therapists, that is a real departure from the status quo in the emergency department. So this place is traditionally staffed by doctors and nurses. So even trying to get build up trust and build up collaboration with these groups involved lots of meetings, lots of presentations. But because the research was underpinned by excellence, excellence in methods, excellence in outputs, excellence in staff involved, students involved, because that helped to build a trust as well. And when the teams started to see tangible outputs that were generated, what they saw was, this is an opportunity for us to build capacity among clinicians. So not just academics or not just researchers. So clinicians will come to the Midwest region because they know they will get excellent clinical training, but they will also be able to advance their career through engaging in research. And given that there is such a huge profile of older adults in the Midwest region, then this is an area of growth and development for this group. So definitely building trust, you know, constant communication, but also support from the chief academic officer. So Paul Burke has been hugely supportive in acting as a bridge across UL and UL Hospitals Group. So having that kind of relationship has certainly enhanced the quality and the impact of the work we do. And I should say that the CEO of UL Hospitals Group and Colette Cowan and her counterpart in the community health organisation are just so supportive of the work that we do and so willing to provide time, expertise, energy, resources in whatever plans that we do, because they were always underpinned by evidence. So our whole approach is that we implement, test evidence-based interventions that are informed by stakeholders, and not just older adults. Stakeholders are often hospital managers, clinicians. You know, it's a very collaborative space. So we should say that we really want to improve services, but also services that are tangible and, you know, implementable, I guess, in clinical practice, so that they reflect the realities of what clinicians face, what managers can implement in the context of, you know, limited resources. So we're very grounded in the research that we do. But what matters most to older adults definitely is underpins everything we do, for sure.
Thanks, Rose, for providing those really interesting insights of the rigor and the relevance, and how you bridge the gap between both. Clearly, Bernard, Una and Monica are going to remain to be very busy, and I think they're going to continue to involve you in everything they do. As we close out today's podcast, maybe we could have a quick fire around the table by Aoife, Christine, Katie and Rose. Just a quick fire as to where next? What are the kind of things you're going to be working on? So we kick off with you, Katie.
Yeah, great. Helena, there's so much going on, you know, across the centre. And Aoife Whiston just mentioned there so nicely just the interdisciplinary focus of the Ageing Research Centre. And we've mentioned a lot today about ED-focused research that's going on, but there's a whole group of researchers in the Ageing Research Centre who focus on painful conditions in older adults, so particularly osteoarthritis, which is very common amongst older adults. And colleagues who are mainly in the discipline of physiotherapy, Professor Karen McCreesh, Dr. Clodagh Toomey and Dr. Helen O'Leary, are all focused at the moment working on funded research projects that are aiming to improve outcomes for older adults who are living with painful conditions through better treatment of conditions like knee osteoarthritis, improving access to exercise programs in the community and better management of chronic pain. So that group of researchers are going to be working on those series of studies over the next couple of years. And just to pick up on something that Monica and Bernard both alluded to earlier on, which is the use of technology in research with older adults. And Monica talked about the challenges of doing digital or electronic signatures for the first time. And she also mentioned that she grew up without electricity. And so for us who are just regular everyday technology users and for whom technology is embedded in our work and our daily lives, it can be easy to forget the challenges that older adults face in accessing and using technology. And our stakeholder panel have certainly hammered that point home to us. And also the concerns that older adults have about being scammed. They're one of the most vulnerable populations in terms of electronic, email-based or phone-based scams. And so two colleagues in the Aging Research Centre, Professor Eta Richardson, who's a software engineer, and Dr. Anne-Marie Morrissey, an occupational therapist, they're partnering with an industry company at the moment, working on a project that's focused on the use of sensors in the home environment. And having that multidisciplinary perspective of people who are excellent on the technology, people who are excellent in terms of understanding the lived experience of older adults, just helps to make sure that the technology solutions they design are reflective of the needs and preferences of older adults and designed in a way that's going to ensure their uptake in practice later on. So that's a couple of examples of things that are going on.
You're going to be busy, Katie. So over to you, Christine. What's on your short-term agenda?
I think one of the most exciting things that is hopefully happening in the new year is a further collaboration with the National Clinical Programme for Older People. And this is kind of linked to what Rose has talked about in terms of how do we explore and capture the experience of older people who are transitioning from care back to the community. And one of the areas that's really interesting to us at the moment that has come out of other collaborations with the national partner is the role of community connectors. So this is a new enough concept in Ireland. It comes from the concept of social prescribing. Because it's in this initial phase, it's really timely that we can try and capture from the outset how we gauge, how we standardise this approach. So we've been delighted to be awarded funding from NCPOP to explore this in more detail, to look at what is the role and the impact of community connectors. What a community connector does really is they're specific in that they're linked to the integrated care programme for older people. And that's the only way that people can use the service. So it's for people who've been using the integrated care programme, they've been discharged. And often when people are finished with the service, there is a kind of lack of support or a lack of knowing where to go next. So this is really a chance for a community connector who don't have a clinical background, but they're part of the integrated care team, to sit down with the older person, do a needs assessment, find out what's important to them. And then it's really about harnessing the local resources that are in the community. And the role of the community connector is to signpost people to different services based on their needs. So whether that's maybe an exercise program, it could be nutrition, it could be bereavement support. Over the course of around 8 weeks, the community connector works with the older person, ranging from telling them about, you know, available services, to making appointments to go to these services, to actually taking them to the appointments themselves. So it's really about taking a kind of holistic view of how do we enhance the social and well-being of older people once they've finished the integrated care team. So we're looking forward to getting that started in the new year, and that will again help inform a kind of standardized way of rolling out the service. So we're hoping to collaborate further with colleagues in Canada who've developed a core outcome set, and we're going to pilot that in the Midwest, as well as helping with kind of practical elements around putting together a repository to have a list of all of the different supports to live well for older people. So like Bernard had mentioned, sometimes people don't really know all of the different services that are available in their area. So we want to make sure that in the Midwest, that there is a clear framework for how community connectors signpost people to these services. And again, from an evidence base, to develop a clear transferable approach that can be rolled out hopefully nationally.
Thanks for sharing that, Christine. You too are going to be very busy. Over to you then, Aoife.
So at the moment, I'm working on a very exciting project within the centre. So it's the Adaptive Physical Activity Study for Stroke. So it's led by Dr. Sarah Hayes. And on our team, we also have Siobhan O'Reilly, a PhD student, and Amy O'Mahony. So essentially, this is a 12-week physical activity intervention that's delivered fully online and linked with wearable devices to track step count and deliver personalised post-stroke rehabilitation care at the home, essentially. We're currently recruiting at the moment. We're almost there, but this is also a little plug for recruitment. Well, it's going well at the moment, so I'm really excited to see where it goes.
Okay, so who would you like to recruit? Keep the plug going now.
So really, actually interesting about this study, it's not limited to older adults. So it's anybody who has had a stroke previously, who has access to a smartphone, and who can attend really UL for one assessment. And other than that, everything else is done from your home. And we work with you weekly to deliver a personalized intervention on your phone.
And Rose, we leave the last word to you on this one.
Yeah, so I think the group have described broadly what projects are ongoing and what we hope to focus on in the new year. But I think back to the genesis of the Aging Research Centre and, you know, reflecting on how we've grown over the past 4 years, like our ambition moving forward is to keep supporting early career academics, early career researchers, clinicians in training, so that we can build capacity, increase the impact, increase networking opportunities, training and education, innovation, collaborations with national and international colleagues, so that the Aging Research Centre at UL can become a national entity in terms of excellence in aging research. And that is our goal moving forward. Absolutely.
You've been listening to the researchers and stakeholder panel members from the Aging Research Centre here at the University of Limerick. I would like to thank you all so much for your time today and congratulations again on your award. If our listeners would like to hear more about research impact at the University of Limerick, please go to our website, ul.ie/research. The research that we've heard about today has benefited from funding from a wide range of sources. These include the Health Research Board, the Health Research Institute at the University of Limerick, the National Emergency Medicine Programme, the National Clinical Programme for Older Persons, the Health Services Executive, and the Irish Research Council. Thank you for listening and see you all next time.